From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, screenwriter John August and veteran producer Dan Jinks talk about working for years in secret to turn Big Fish the movie into Big Fish the musical. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, the Toronto International Film Festival is underway, and fans get downright sadistic over the casting on 50 Shades of Grey. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I am joined by my co-banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, the Toronto International Film Festival is underway. Some of the films that you caught in Telluride are there, and these are films that could very well be Oscar-bound. After all, playing those two festivals worked for Slumdog Millionaire and Argo and The King's Speech. But there are also some movies that haven't been seen before and, you know, movies that aren't even finished that people are trying to sell.
Yeah, let's deal with the first category, movies that played at Telluride. Top of the list, 12 Years a Slave. That's director Steve McQueen, who did Shame and Hunger, his account of the true story of somebody kidnapped in the 1840s and sold into slavery. Jason Reitman's Labor Day, his adaptation of the Joyce Maynard novel of the same name. And Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity, a outer space thriller with George Clooney and Sandra Bullock. So those are the movies that were seen in Telluride, will probably do very well in Toronto. And then there's a whole other crop of movies that will debut in Toronto, including John Wells' adaptation of the famous play August, Osage County. There is Matthew McConaughey and Dallas Buyers Club. There's a new movie about Julian Assange. Almost 300 movies are going to show in Toronto. We don't know yet what's going to hit. And some of the movies are going there looking for a distributor that aren't even finished yet.
Yes. One of the standouts in that area is Jon Stewart's debut as a director, Rosewater, which is based on this Iranian journalist who appeared on The Daily Show and then got into very grim trouble with the Iranian police who picked him up and tortured him, and terrible things happened. And Jon Stewart took a leave of absence from The Daily Show to do this. It's obviously a passion project. And he is going to Toronto. He's going to show some footage. It's not done, and see if he can sell this thing.
Yeah, and this is also from producer Scott Rudin, who made No Country for Old Men. He has the new Coen Brothers film, Inside Llewyn Davis. So a pretty good pedigree, even though Jon Stewart, you wouldn't really associate with grim material like this film.
I am mesmerized by Blue is the Warmest Color, a film that played in Cannes and won the Palme d'Or. This is a three-hour film about a love story between two young women. And by all accounts, I would say truly a harrowing shoot. There's a very explicit 10-minute sex scene. And these two young actresses who are starring in this film had given an interview leading up to this festival in which they completely said that it was a terrible experience, that they would never work with this director again. They described him having an unbelievable tantrum after they did 100 takes of this very brief scene where they meet. And on one of the 100th take, they said they started laughing and he started throwing his monitor and screaming that he couldn't work in these conditions. It just sounds truly like the shoot from hell, went way over the original length of shoot into a 5.5-month ordeal, take after take. And the director fired back.
Yeah, the director is Abdellatif Kashishi, and he went after his actors, specifically his lead actor, Léa Seydoux. And he did it not in an interview, but at a news conference with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. So I think we can just about kiss its Golden Globe chances away. And I should add as a footnote, the film is ineligible this year to be France's foreign language submission because it was released too late in France. Regardless, the stories about the making of this film, the director, Kashishi, is now saying that he went over budget and it took very long to shoot this film because his actors, specifically Seydoux, were incompetent. And to get a good performance out of them required multiple takes and long days. So if the story of the making of the movie is as good as the film itself, it could be an interesting project to watch.
Although it will be NC-17, which is very rare, as you know. So that will be a major asterisk on the fate of this particular film. And, you know, John, and that leads me right into a segue about another piece of news in the industry this week, which involves the casting of 50 Shades of Grey. It will not be NC-17, whatever happens. It's based on this E.L. James book, and it's very, I haven't read it, I confess, but I gather there's a lot of S&M and explicit sexual stuff. And finally, the cast was unveiled, and the fan reaction, not so good.
Yeah, the casting in the lead roles was Dakota Johnson, who is the daughter of Melanie Griffith and Don Johnson, as Anastasia Steele. I think the title of her character suggests how good this book really is. And having read a little bit of it, I can tell you, Kim, privately, it's not that good. And Charlie Hunnam from Sons of Anarchy as Christian Grey, who's kind of the businessman who induces Anastasia to his red room of pain. But the thing that is, I have to say, is almost laughable is that not only that fans would be upset about it, but they'd start petitioning about it just as they did when Ben Affleck was cast in the part of Batman.
Lots and lots of negative reaction on Twitter, and it shows you these things, which are very popular, can become like a blood sport for the fans, you know, that they go online, they sign these petitions, they say this is an outrage. Sometimes they quickly forget about it. Back when Michael Keaton was cast in the original Batman, there was a lot of outcry, and people forgot about it pretty fast. Of course, that was in a pre-internet era, so it's hard to say whether this gathers more energy now.
Yeah, and I would point out that Michael Keaton, even though in that pre-Twitter era he was blasted as being a bad pick, those movies with Tim Burton turned out incredibly well. So, I mean, a lot of chatter over this casting. I think as the producer of 50 Shades of Grey said, maybe they weren't the first picks. Maybe they're complicating factors. But I think these people need to move on with their lives and just wait for the film to come out.
Let me just be specific. I think you're interpreting a tweet from the producer, one of the producers, Dana Brunetti, as meaning a lot of people didn't want to do it, which is probably true. But I will quote him verbatim. He tweeted, "There's a lot that goes into casting that isn't just looks, talent, availability, their desire to do it, chemistry with other actor, etc." And he pleads, keep that in mind while hating and keep perspective. I should just say that Dana Brunetti has been a guest on the show. He's a producer who works with Kevin Spacey. They have a company, Trigger Street, and they do, you know, really, they're producers on The Social Network, very high-end stuff. And that's of a piece with the way that E.L. James, the author, has asked for this to be released. It's a Focus Films release. That's Universal's art house banner. She wanted that pedigree, I'm told, for this project. So they're doing everything they can to make this something other than what it seems to be. Right, John?
Yeah. And I think what seems to be is the big question. I mean, I think it's one thing for millions of women, this book was a huge bestseller, to read 50 Shades of Grey on their Kindle or their iPad or in the privacy of their own homes. It's a very different question to actually buy a ticket and be seen walking into a movie theater where the film is playing. This felt to me from the very beginning like a much better HBO miniseries than a feature film, but we'll see how it turns out.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can keep up with us on Facebook at KCRW's The Business and on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John's is at JG Horn. And our producer, Darby Maloney, is at Darby KCRW. Coming up, making Big Fish the movie into Big Fish the musical. Tim Burton's 2003 film Big Fish is a story about a son struggling to connect with his dying father, a fanciful storyteller whose tall tales come to life on film. Screenwriter John August wrote the script based on a book by Daniel Wallace. But August wasn't nearly done with the material. For the last 9 years, he has toiled, secretly at first, to turn Big Fish into a Broadway musical. The show is now in previews at the Neil Simon Theater in New York. To transform Big Fish into a musical, John August teamed up with two of the film's producers, Dan Jenks and Bruce Cohen. None of them had experience on Broadway, so their learning curve was steep. They filled out the team with Tony-nominated composer and lyricist Andrew Lippa, who did the musical version of The Addams Family. When John August and Dan Jenks came to KCRW recently, August explained that he'd wanted to make Big Fish the musical ever since he first read the novel in the late 90s. At the time, he was working on building a screenwriting career that began with the well-received 1999 comedy Go and continued with Charlie's Angels the following year.
So I'd read this book by Daniel Wallace, which I loved to death, and convinced Columbia Pictures to buy the rights to this book for me. And I started writing it as a movie, and it took a long time to get together, and I finally got it to Dan Jenks and Bruce Cohen, who produced it. We got it to Tim Burton. We were able to make the movie. But even when I was first working on those first drafts, I felt like there was something musical about it. In the movie I wrote, there's one musical number. There's a song called Twice the Love the Siamese twins sing. It was the first time I'd written lyrics for a song. I was like, you kind of want these characters to sing. When we finished the film and we had the first test screening, I had dinner with Dan and Bruce, and I said, I really think there's a Broadway musical here. I think these characters want to sing. I think there's an internal life that's very hard to put on the screen with just words.
And you were brought in, Dan, by John as producer of the film.
Yeah, he was just finishing up the first draft of the screenplay at Sony Pictures, and there was not a producer attached to it. And John and I had known each other since John first came to town and started writing screenplays, and we've been wanting to work together. And he said, would you take a look at this?
The lucky situation was that Dan and Bruce had just done American Beauty, which was an amazing film that was both small and big and hugely award-winning. And so, therefore, it was very easy to say, like, what if I gave it to Dan Jinks and Bruce Cohen?
I'm going to backtrack and add something to John's story. Daniel Wallace wrote a really beautiful, beautiful novel. It was not obviously a movie. And Sony Pictures bought this for John August for one reason, because John had become their savior. They put him on every movie they were making at the time, and he was saving all these giant films. So he brought this book to them. I honestly don't think they had any intention of making this into a motion picture. But
just
they bought it because
okay,
they kind
John,
of owed John one.
What you want for Christmas or Hanukkah.
He ended up writing a really, really beautiful and very moving script. And then we were able to get some attention from people in the town who were excited about it. And that's how the movie came to be.
Did you know that John harbored a secret plan to make it into a musical early on?
Well, you know,
he said he told you.
John knew that I come from theater. That's how I started out. And I'm a huge musical theater geek. I kind of see every show. That's sort of my addiction is going to see musicals. And in that very first conversation, John started talking about these fantasy sequences that were in the movie and how those could all be musical numbers and how on screen, two different actors, Ewan McGregor and Albert Finney, had played the same character, but on stage, there would be something wonderfully theatrical about one guy playing the whole show and going back and forth throughout the show. At one time, he'll be a 65-year-old man in bed dying, and a second later, he's a 16-year-old boy going on a great adventure.
The story of Big Fish is really a story about storytelling, and storytelling works really nicely on the stage because you're asking the audience to participate in the storytelling with you, to believe that this actor is now 16 years old, or this actor is now 65 years old. In a movie, those things become very literal. Like, there's a close-up of an actor, and you see, like, well, that person is obviously not that age. So I just thought there was an opportunity to do some really amazing things, to have the audience really participate in this story with us, to put
Although
it on stage.
Although in Benjamin Button, they certainly
absolutely. And so
did it.
When we first talked about making Big Fish for the movie, we had those conversations about, like, could you take Jack Nicholson and age him down digitally and age him up digitally so it was one person that you're looking at the whole time through? And they did some tests, but it just wasn't sort of true to what the movie wanted to be. On stage, though, that's really natural. We come in with our suspension of disbelief greatly heightened. And so we accept that, like, that desk represents an entire room. We accept that, you know, that shift of lights is, you know, a change in scenery. So those were going to be really helpful things for us on stage.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Big Fish the Musical was a delicate process for screenwriter John August, so for years he worked on it in secret with composer Andrew Lippa and two of the producers of the movie version, Dan Jinks and Bruce Cohen. Jinks and August say it was important to them to keep the project off the industry's radar.
For the first, I'd say, 6 years we were working on the musical, we really didn't want people to know we were working on it because it was so nice to have this bubble of not just secrecy, but sort of intimacy, where we could just focus on making the thing right and not have to worry about sort of press or attention or other people sort of getting involved. You know, I was working on other movies, but I was, every couple of months, Dan and Bruce would come and we'd play the new stuff for them. So I was writing other movies, and Andrew went off and did The Addams Family. We all went off and did different things. I went off and directed this movie called The Nines. But every once in a while, we get back together and sort of rekindle this thing. And it is sort of like building a little campfire. You have to start with, like, just this tiny little spark and very carefully add in, you know, little tidbits of tinder and then some bigger wood and some bigger wood and bigger wood, and be very careful about how you're doing it, because if you just try to do it all at once, you're just going to have a disaster.
But, you know, part of our philosophy was we all knew going into this that an original musical with an original score, particularly a very big musical, which this is in many ways, would take a long time. And we just didn't want to be those guys who were talking about something at a dinner party, you know, and every time we would see our friends, so how's that old thing going?
Yeah.
So we basically didn't talk about it at all until really until we had already done our first reading of it in New York. We already had a director attached, and then we finally started talking about it, and people would say, oh, that's why you were spending so much time in New York over the last few years.
So how did you figure out how to be a Broadway finance guy?
You know, that has been the hardest part of the job. It's a totally new world for me. I've done a bunch of movies and TV series. I never had to raise money before. I've had a lot of great mentors along the journey. A couple of Broadway guys, Nick Scandalius from the Nederlander Organization, a great guy named Roy Furman, who is a producer and co-producer on a lot of Broadway shows, plus a lot of Hollywood people. People like Bob Greenblatt, who now runs NBC, produced 9 to 5 a few years ago, and Mark Platt, who produced Wicked, is somebody that I've spoken to a bunch. And a lot of people like that were very open and wonderful about giving advice along the way. And we did a couple of readings where we would invite a lot of the people who traditionally will put money into shows. And the nice news is they responded so positively to the readings. The very first reading we did, which we kept very, very small, we got a huge standing ovation, and everybody was in tears at the end. And that helped a lot. And then word started to spread. And then on a couple of occasions, people actually called me to say, hey, I hear really wonderful things that you're doing something so special. Can I be a part of it?
It has been a very different experience from making a movie or making a TV show, because usually you're making something for Hollywood. You're going to one place and asking for the money, and you're trying to make it that way. Here you're going to a bunch of different places, and they're not asking to read a script. They're asking you to perform the script for them. So Andrew Lippman and I have been at a piano singing the show for years and years and years. And so that change of being sort of the performer of the piece and not just the writer of the piece has been different.
By the way, John just brought up something that has been one of my favorite parts of this entire process, that for the first 7 years of working on this musical, before we did our first reading with a full cast, John August and Andrew Lippa would perform the entire show, or however much of the show had been written. Sometimes it was just three songs. Sometimes it was five songs for me and Bruce Cohen, my producing partner, and whomever else we could drag into the room. And it was such a great experience. It was so much fun, and they were so terrific doing it, that the first time we did our first reading, my guess is we were probably a little bit more far along in the process than other shows with our first readings, because we had probably done 30, 35 mini readings where it was just John and Andrew doing every single part themselves.
So Dan was saying that he had gone to a number of producers with experience on Broadway. Did you do a similar kind of thing with writers?
I did. I talked to a couple of screenwriters who'd written for Broadway, because I just wanted to sort of know what the book writer's role and function was, because it's not exactly what a screenwriter's function normally is. What a screenwriter, you tend to sort of like, you give somebody the script and then you see them at the premiere a lot of times. You're not heavily involved in the production. A lot of times you're just the person who put the words down, and then they're going to say whatever they're going to say, and you show up and you have a drink at the party. But it's also not what a TV writer does, because a TV writer is creating that show, and you are there every moment and every decision is yours. And it's sort of a third thing where Andrew Lippa and I, who's really the other writer, and you sort of have to think of us as one pair, one team.
Is he doing the songs, music, and lyrics?
He's doing music and lyrics.
Okay.
But Andrew and I were sort of together in the room for almost everything that was written. There was very little that sort of like he went off and did something and I went off and did something and they got glued together. We were always sort of together talking through every decision. And we have a lot of say. It's our thing. But ultimately, the collaboration between all the different people involved, Dan and Bruce, Susan Stroman, all the different departments, it's much more of a team thing than anything I've done in Hollywood.
After a short break, August and Jinx explain why they spent $2 million to launch Big Fish in Chicago before hitting Broadway. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
Hi, this is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. Catch up with The Business and lots of film and television news on our Facebook page. Search for KCRW's The Business and click like.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. John August is a veteran screenwriter who shares his experience and insights into the trade on his blog and on a podcast that he hosts with fellow screenwriter Craig Mazin. August has long been more than fully employed, but for several years he also worked in secret on turning Big Fish, which he'd adapted for the screen, into a Broadway musical. Now that show has just started previews at the Neil Simon Theater in New York. August and producers Dan Jinks and Bruce Cohen are all film veterans, so they had a lot to learn about creating a musical for the stage. At one point, they considered casting Michael C. Hall, the star of Dexter, in the lead role. But ultimately, seasoned Broadway performer and two-time Tony winner Norbert Leo Butz took the part. He's not a household name, but Jinks explains that that is okay.
Most completely new musicals don't have big stars. Wicked, when it opened on Broadway, Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel were huge talents, and they were theater names, but they weren't names beyond it. Book of Mormon, the stars were not known. Jersey Boys, the stars were not known. Once, Lion King. Most of the shows that we think about as being very, very big hits don't have real big stars in them, whereas if you're doing a revival or something, or a play, you really have to have a big star. The problem when you have a huge star is if, you know, if John Travolta is starring in your show, I use that name, somebody we never talked about. The minute John Travolta leaves, nobody wants to see the show because, oh, John Travolta's gone. Right. I don't want to see the show now because he's no longer in the show. To open with somebody who's a huge star in the theater world, it's much easier to replace them. And our big hope is that this is a show that can run for many years.
The thing I've come to appreciate about Broadway actors is it's almost an athletic ability because to be able to do something once on camera is terrific. To be able to do it 8 times a week is a completely different skill set. Their endurance has been remarkable.
I don't know where you must have started this well before the Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark became such a big thing years before, but did it scare you? This is a show that was not previewed out of town.
We decided from our very first conversations that we were going to do an out-of-town tryout. And I'll tell you something, there were a lot of people who brought up the idea of not going out of town. Going out of town adds more than $2.5 million to the budget of a musical, the cost of doing a show out of town. Spider-Man was such a ridiculously humongous show that they really couldn't.
They could. The stunts were almost impossible to set up somewhere else, I guess.
We did some research, and in the last 30 years, there have been 3 really successful musicals that did not go out of town, Book of Mormon being one of them. But before Book of Mormon, it was City of Angels, which was like in the late
Long
80s,
ago,
and then
yeah.
Nine, which was many years before
time.
That.
Mm-hmm.
So we always knew we wanted to go out of town. And the show got really, really wonderful reviews in Chicago, but most of the reviews said we still had some tinkering to do.
There's certain things which, when you're 5 feet away from the performer, make a certain kind of sense, when you can see that close-up kind of. But when you're in the balcony seats, things just read differently. And sometimes you need to have different information. Sometimes you need to not just change the lines, but really change how that whole scene works because it just doesn't make as much sense 30 feet away. And that's what was so valuable about being in Chicago, is really seeing what it's like in a dark theater. Most people listening to the show are probably more film people, and it's like having a test screening of your film. It's like you're having a test screening every night, and that's exhausting, but it's also a huge advantage because we can go through, and in the afternoons, we could make some changes and see what those changes did. And so I could change a line and see if it got a bigger laugh. Or we could, you know, in some cases, switch out a whole song and see if that song helps propel this moment better in the show. That was a remarkable gift to have that in Chicago. I can't imagine making the show now without having had that.
It seems like a wise investment. I mean, were people pressuring you not to do it?
You know, I don't want to say people were pressuring. A lot of people brought up when we were trying to keep our budget numbers down as much as we could because, you know, these things, we didn't want to, fortunately, our budget was not even remotely close to a Spider-Man kind of a budget. But there's always pressure to keep the numbers down. And certainly a lot of people brought up the fact that here we could chop off $2.5 million in one fell swoop. But it was not the smartest thing for the show.
One of the things I learned most about sort of watching this whole process is when you're making a movie, you're just like, you're raising the money to make that movie and just make that movie because you're making one thing. As if had to figure out the budgets for this show, they have to think not just about how to get open the first night, but how to make it sustainable so that we can run and run and run and run.
And tour.
And tour and do all these other things. And so I'm used to making things that have to exist once. And making something that can be repeated again and again and again is a very different process.
What are the big ticket items on these things, Dan?
The set is a huge item. And because this is a show about a guy who tells these great stories, and every time he tells a story, we go to a new place, which means the entire cast has new costumes. Every 10 minutes, they're in entirely new costumes. So that's another giant item. Advertising is a huge item. Rehearsal time is a huge item. It's amazing how it all adds up. And we have lots and lots of meetings about how to keep things down. But this is a big show. And this is a, you know, Broadway theater tickets are not cheap now, and people want a real theatrical experience. And having seen the show in Chicago, I can say we really offer that. This is a very emotional show on the one hand, and a huge, big, fun theatrical experience on the other hand.
Obviously, this was something you truly wanted to do, John, but was there any element thinking, you know, movies are less fun and I want to do something that's not a movie?
Yeah, I think after you make 10 movies, you sort of know how movies get made. And so you're always looking for, like, what's the different thing to do? And so I've done some TV shows and I've learned sort of how TV shows are made. And this was just a completely new thing. And it was just a chance to flex some different muscles. I also just really loved the writing of it because there's just things you can do on stage that you couldn't do in a standard movie. And I love the fact that an actor can take two steps forward and be in a new location. I was so looking forward to that opportunity and just to have an audience around you experiencing this thing at the same time you're experiencing it. So it was a chance to do new things. I've always been the kind of person who looks for the new, different thing to do. That's why I develop apps. That's why I do the blog, why I do a podcast. I'm always looking for the next thing.
And Dan?
You know, it's such a fascinating time in the movie business. This has been a wake-up call this summer, as many people have written about, the fact that so far there have been six, not just flops, but
big
humongous
ones.
Flops. I hope that something good is going to come out of that. And the thing that I hope will happen is that Hollywood will again realize that there is a great market for movies in that $30 to $60 million range, which is where most of the movies that I've made fall into that. Actually, I made a couple of movies that were studio movies that were made for less money than that. But I'm learning about new businesses. I got into TV a few years ago because some of the best work, some of the best writing is happening on television.
Right.
It's a really interesting place to be. And I've gotten four series on the air so far, which I'm really proud of. I'm also learning every day about how movies are being put together in new ways now and talking to different kinds of financiers that I never thought I would have to learn about.
Right.
But it's really interesting, and it's how interesting movies are happening right now. Interesting movies are still getting made, but they're it's less often that they're getting made by Paramount, Universal, and Fox. I'll tell you something funny. For years, I've said, if it's not based on a comic book, forget it. Hollywood's not going to make it. And indeed, last December, I sold a comic book that my development executive and I worked on a writer to create. We sold it to Fox, and now I have a comic book in development. I never thought I'd be that guy. I happen to really, really like it a lot, but
comic book.
you want to stay in business. You have to figure out how to do that in 2013.
So is this it for you now, John? Are you ruined for movies?
I love movies, and I really want to make movies. And I wanted to direct another movie in the time that we've been doing Big Fish, and it just hasn't been possible because there were these icebergs that were sort of in the calendar, the year-long calendar of, like, I'm not going to be available for this month because we're doing Big Fish in New York or all these things. And so over the years, I've had frustrated conversations with my producers. It's been because the schedule just takes so long, and trying to carve out 8 months where I could direct a movie has been really tough. So that'll be my priority after Big Fish. But I've loved the process of making a musical, and I want to do it again.
John August is a screenwriter. He's also written the book for the new Broadway musical, Big Fish. Dan Jinks is a producer. He co-produced the film Big Fish and the musical. Thank you guys both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps. And you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.